Hello and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, where we talk movies, movie trailers, movie news, and a couple fun movie segments. I'm Cameron Slanin, and tonight I'm joined by Jake Brown and Trevor Allison. The gang's all back together, boys.
Yep.
Good to be here.
Good to be back. Alrighty, well, we got a lot to get through tonight. We're going to be reviewing Detroit, have a couple news segments, we have a bunch of trailers to talk, and we're also going to do another segment on honorable mentions. So let's kind of just jump right into what we're going to do. Jake, we're going to open up with a Jake's Ranting Rants. So Jake, what are we ranting about this week?
You guys were kind enough to give me the platform to rant about something that I didn't think needed ranting on, but then I thought about it, and oh wait, it does. This is about the Despicable Me franchise becoming the highest grossing animated film franchise of all time, which, you know, that hurts me. So let me just paint the picture here. First movie, pretty good. Second movie, pretty bad. Everything else makes me want to die. Now, I'm not just describing the Despicable Me series, which is, like I said, now somehow the highest grossing animated film series of all time. God help us. But I am also describing Shrek, the series it dethroned. Because here's the thing with most animation studios, guys. Once they get one critically and audience acclaimed film, they just rape and pillage it into a money printing machine of spin-offs and toys and video games and movies and TV shows and Netflix short films. Guys, Puss in Boots has 3 films, a solo TV series, and 3 video games. Yikes. We are on our way with that, with Despicable Me. Despicable Me has 4 films released so far, with a Minions 2 coming in 2020, 9 short films, 3 video games, and a Minions theme park at Universal Studios. I did not think it was possible to make a dumber decision than Disney making Avatar World, but Universal was like, hold my beer, fam. Here we go. I'm on it. So I'll concede that the Minions are kind of funny for like 30 seconds, but they are yellow Tic Tacs speaking gibberish for an hour and a half. That would be like Pixar making a feature of just the little alien green guys going, for an hour and a half. But you know what? I can't blame Illumination because Minions was number one at the box office for 3 weeks when it came out. Kids love it. And who am I to rant about kids loving a movie made for children? Oh, wait, tons of adults love this too and people get Minion tattoos? Are you kidding me? And let me just tell you something about Minions. Let me just tell you something, Minions, you little guys. Mario owns overalls. He owns them. So take your goggles and your little yellow butts and get out of here.
Let me just say, I'm so happy 1,000 people didn't listen to our Transformers episode and I didn't have to join the ranks of those with Minions tattoos.
It's possible.
Now, if I was to say that there were 4 franchises ahead of Toy Story on the all-time animated list, and we've already know 2 of them, Despicable Me and Shrek. What are the other 2? Any guesses?
Hey, I looked up this list, so I know what they are.
Dang it, Trevor.
Sorry, but I'm freaking pissed. I had no idea there were 5 Ice Age movies. I knew there were
5
2.
Ice Age movies.
Like, are you serious? The
first
Ice Age
is
great.
I'm going to guess 1's How to Train Your Dragon.
Nope.
Really?
Wow. How to Train Your Dragon How to Train Your Dragon is number 10.
Wow.
Number 4. Jake, it's another DreamWorks property.
The only one I know is Shrek.
No. Madagascar.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yep.
Dude, DreamWorks just like runs stuff into the ground. It's
DreamWorks
kind of absurd.
Has 6 of the top 10. So just, or I guess 5. Because Despicable Me is Illumination. And I guess Ice Age is Illumination, or I don't know what Ice Age is. But Shrek, Madagascar, Kung Fu Panda, and How to Train Your Dragon. Finding Nemo is number 6 with only 2 films.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah,
I will say Kung Fu Panda and How to Train Your Dragon are great, especially How to Train Your Dragon. Like, so good.
Yeah.
I think that Finding Dory made $1 billion.
Yeah, it did. I think it made $1,028,000,000.
Yeah, I just can't. So. I had no idea there were four Madagascar films. I just, whenever I see the marketing for these things, I tune them out because they're all the same, whether they are part of a continuous franchise or not. I mean, it's just, you can tell like 15 seconds into an animated trailer what the movie is going to be.
But guys, yeah, it has King Julian.
I think we're going to see a lot more of this happen with the revolution of streaming services because animated films are so cheap to make compared to live production.
Yeah.
And especially sequels. Like, I think what's going to happen is an animated film is going to come out for kids, make a ton of money. Netflix picks up the rights to it. And then they put out once a year 10 short films based on that series and just keep raking it in.
It's even cheaper than what everyone did in the 90s with direct to VHS about the same thing. I mean, we got,
oh yeah,
you know, Aladdin Return of Jafar, which is garbage. Aladdin is
great.
I will
say that one of the interesting things is that, kind of tying into this, is that Disney announced today that they are doing their own streaming service. They're pulling all their stuff off Netflix. They're going to launch their own paid streaming service.
Does that include 30 for 30?
I hope so. 30 for 30, like, all the new ones haven't been on Netflix, have they?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I hate this. Like, there's already too many streaming services, and we're basically just creating cable on the internet where you have to pay for each channel.
There's nothing
new
under the sun.
The idea of having to pay for 10 different $8 subscriptions is the most infuriating thing.
Yeah, like, I'm just going to get cable again.
Yeah. You have made us go back to wanting to have cable, everybody. Great.
Maybe this is actually just a play by, like, Comcast and Time Warner to be like, yes, come back to us.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Oh, man.
So, all right, let's move on to the next piece, which kind of feeds into this and the idea of just, you know, trying to money grab every single thing physically possible, I guess. And that is The Office and 30 Rock revivals at NBC. NBC came out this week saying that they were interested in reviving both The Office and 30 Rock with the original cast. Now, I'm pretty sure we're all fans of The Office, all fans of 30 Rock. Wow, what did you guys think of this news?
Okay, we could have a mini Trevor's ranting rants on this. like have a freaking idea. Like, come on. There are so many people that have good ideas that don't get a chance because people are afraid to try stuff. We got shows like freaking Arrested Development getting canceled after 3 seasons because nobody knows what it is or how to market it correctly. I mean, come on. This is so dumb. They also, the same things have been mentioned as with ER and The West Wing. ER, I don't feel so strongly about since it had a revolving cast anyway. Like, bring the thing back and keep it rolling, whatever. It's the same show as Hospital Chicago or whatever else that is. And
Chicago I just, Hospital, Trevor.
Right, yeah. So
it was started by people that went to Baylor. Know your college.
I mean, as a Baylor film grad, I'm somewhat ashamed.
Well,
to
actually,
be in the same room as them.
I think that Wanted is the only movie we're allowed to watch, actually.
That's true.
We might
that
be breaking
Too Fast,
rules
Too
on
Furious.
This podcast. Yeah. So anyway, no, this is stupid. Especially 30 Rock. The way 30 Rock ends ties everything up so perfectly. I don't see Tina Fey being in on this. The Office already was still great, but struggled a little bit without Steve Carell. Like, how are you going to reboot that? Like, I don't need to see like BJ Novak doing the douchebag intern cycle over and over again for 10 more years. Like this doesn't need to happen. This is stupid.
What is interesting is that Netflix or the NBC did pass on the Dwight Schrute TV show. They had that Dwight Schrute episode in the final season. And that was originally going to be the pilot for a TV show when NBC didn't pick it up. They threw it into the final season, reworked it to where it made a little bit more sense within the context of the show. And so they passed on this. This feels like the cheapest. this feels like TV, which has had great ideas for the longest time, is now getting into the remake business just as movies have, and that's just the worst idea.
Well, and it's already happened with Will and Grace right now. It's coming out end of September, and they've already renewed it for a second season of new Will and Grace.
The problem is coming from the big three, basically Fox, CBS, NBC, and ABC, big four, I guess. Because I mean, they're national broadcast. They're not able to take the risks like HBO and AMC and FX are, because it's over the air cable essentially, and anybody can watch it. So I understand that it's probably hard for them to come up with ideas that compete with what's being put out on TV today, but I'm with Trevor. I mean, like, The Office probably went on for a season or two too long, but that finale is probably the best finale ever in the history of TV.
It's so great.
And 30 Rock, I think, maybe went on for a season too long as well. But I mean, like Trevor said, it's just these shows are designed to end when they're supposed to end. Like, the writers know it's the last season, so they tie up all the plot lines and storylines and give the characters their full development and their full due. And to, like, it's almost, it feels like Frankenstein's monster. It's like, this isn't right. We're bringing something back from the dead, and it's wrong.
Yeah. I can't say I'm completely out. The Office is my favorite TV show of all time. And so it's one of those things, and I said this, the thing I always say is that if it's good, yeah, I'm totally in for it. But the odds are that it's bad, and in that case, you're ruining something that so many people cherish. Like, I would rather have NBC in primetime just replay episodes of The Office than get new episodes. Because
I think more people would watch that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Let's move on to the next bit, because we got a lot to get to. And that is that the Avengers actors for Infinity War Part 1 and whatever the second film is being called were not given the script. The studio, Kevin Feige, Russo brothers, decided that each actor would just be given the lines that they are saying and some context to back that up. What do you guys think about this level of secrecy on films?
So, as a person that kind of works with actors, I try and put myself in the head of actors, and as an actor, I would hate this, but at the same time, I totally get it and understand why Marvel's doing it. I mean, if you look at all of the digital attacks that studios have gone under, like HBO right now is under attack by hackers for ransom of millions of dollars because they have executive emails and copies of Game of Thrones. And yeah. This Marvel has basically been setting this up for 22 movies. So they definitely want to play it close to the chest. So I get it. But at the same time, it would be super frustrating as a actor and director and, I don't know. I think that just shows that they have a lot of goodwill with the people that they work with for them to accept this and be cool with it. And they're just trying to be as cautious as possible for what is essentially the payoff of billions of dollars of investment.
Yeah. I should say this isn't the first time this has happened. There are reports that when Christopher Nolan was doing The Dark Knight Rises, he only had a copy of the script on a thumb drive. And when you wanted to read the script, you had to read it in a room at his house with him watching you, pretty much. The script never left his side. And so, I mean, it's not the first time we've seen this, but it's definitely interesting that this is becoming a more common practice, I guess. Trevor, what do you think?
I think it's pretty hilarious. I read a couple places that that they did this because they were really concerned about Tom Holland, who talks too much or something. Because he accidentally gave away a spoiler, or almost gave away a spoiler in an interview with, is it with Benedict Cumberbatch or something? I don't remember. Yeah. But he like
he actually
he
did.
Like he like almost yeah. gave something away, and then he like Cumberbatch like cut him off.
There's this thought that, or not thought, but like Tom Holland just cannot keep things to himself, and so there is actually now, whenever he gives interviews, a person standing off camera watching him and telling him pretty much like what he can and can't say, and he has to like, if he even thinks like, hey, this isn't something you could use, pretty much has to be like, no, like get it approved by a Marvel executive beforehand.
He even said that one of his fight scenes he was filming, they didn't tell him who he was fighting. Nope. He was just
filmed
the motion
in a CGI suit because they wouldn't even let him know what version of the Spider-Man costume he was wearing.
Wow.
It's hilarious. I also read, I don't know how true this is, because I know we said that like no one got a full script. Apparently, Dave Bautista literally only read his lines. Like he said he didn't want to know anything until he saw it in the theater himself.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
But Jake, you hit on a good point of like from the actor's perspective. And I think what's funny is like as an actor, like you know what happens in the movie, but like many of these actors are going to sit down, watch this movie in the theater, and for the first time get the same experience that we get when we watch it, because they'll not have the same, they won't have all the pieces like we don't either. And so that's, I guess that's a pretty interesting perspective to look at it from.
Yeah, especially because they're shooting most of it on a green screen soundstage in Atlanta, you know? So, yeah. I mean, like you said, with Tom Holland, like they don't even know what the environments look like or who they're fighting or, which is going to, I'm going to be like super critical and analyzing the performances and stuff like that. But I mean, it's Marvel. They have a pretty good track record. So,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. They've done 16 films pretty well. Well, you know, probably like 13 of those 16 pretty well, but that's a pretty good track record. 13 for 16 in baseball. That'd get you a lot of rewards. Let's move on to honorable mentions. Now, for those of you guys who didn't listen to our Dunkirk episode, I'm going to kind of re-go over the rules once again. So this is a list of people that we feel are worthy of being mensches. And mensches is an old Yiddish term for a good or honorable person. So to be on this list, it must be a unanimous vote. We must all vote yes. One of us is going to nominate somebody. The rest of us will vote. The person must have been in or worked on more than 5 films. And the biggest part is, do they pass the blind test? Which is, if I knew nothing about a film that other than they were involved in it, would that be enough to make me go see it? And the two people that were nominated in last time were Spielberg and the Coen brothers. So 3 people, actually. And we didn't put Harrison Ford in because of, we all love Harrison Ford, but we don't know if Harrison Ford alone is enough to get us into the theater. So I hope that gives you guys a good perspective on it. But let's go ahead and get into our nominees for honorable mensches. Jake, who's your nominee to be an honorable mensch?
Okay, so I'm determined to get an actor on this list because I think directors, especially modern day directors, tend to get people to the theater more than actors do. But there is one actor that has already been mentioned in this podcast, so that's why I'm bringing him up, that gets me to the theater, or at least like gets me to want to see it. I might not be able to make it to the theater, but just because he is in it, I want to see this film because I think he's one of the best and most underappreciated actors of his generation, and that is the amazing Steve Carell.
Oh, not where I thought this was going. What I'm wrestling with is, do I love The Office enough to make anything else that he's been involved with disappear? I mean, he's been in some great, he's been on a tear lately with like Foxcatcher, The Way Way Back. There are things like Dinner for Schmucks that make me have pause.
So here's my quick counter argument to that is,
okay.
So the incredible Burt Wonderstone or whatever piece of crap that was that came out, like I knew it was going to be bad, but I was like, but Steve Carell's in it and he is so funny. So I'm not going to go to the theater to see it, but like I'm willing to watch this piece of crap because Steve Carell's in it.
All right. Yeah. I'll say I'm leaning towards yes. I especially like serious Steve Carell.
Yeah.
I think he can obviously be funny. I think that I don't know that he's funny enough to carry movies like he sometimes has been tasked with doing. I mean, obviously he is Michael Gary Scott and forever will be one of the five greatest television characters of all time. And that's like not even up for debate, but yeah, I think, I don't know that I would have said yes 5 years ago, but I think I say yes now, especially like I said, when he's in serious roles, I think him as Bobby Riggs in Battle of the Sexes is going to be pretty entertaining.
And guys, he now has the highest grossing animated film series of all time.
Oh, gosh.
Come on.
Wait, Jake, let me ask you this.
He does great work
then.
In those movies.
Yeah,
Jake,
I mean,
that means
really
that you
funny.
Are willing to go see Despicable Me just because he's in it. That's what you're arguing.
I mean, the first one, like when the first one came out, I saw it in theaters and thought it was great because Steve Carell was the voice of Gru. And like I saw the second one in theaters too because I thought the first one was pretty great. And then after the second one, I was like, ah, man, I don't know. But like the third one, I won't go to see it in theaters. But like if it comes to Netflix, I'll probably watch it because Steve Carell's in it.
But that's the thing is like, is it, because it's not just like, is it enough? Well, I guess it is just enough to make you see the film. Trevor, you're a yes, right?
I think I'm a yes.
Gosh, I love Steve Carell so much. This is so hard because there's part of me that's like, well, yeah, he's a great guy. And then there's the honorable mensch side of me that's like, but is he mentionable? Is he mensch enough?
It's Michael Scott.
It's Michael Gary Scott. I'm gonna go with a yes. I'll give you. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll put Gary in there.
Yes.
I'll give it to him. I'll give it to him for The Big Short and Foxcatcher.
And Crazy Stupid Love.
Gosh, that's sad. Brick Tamlin,
40-year-old
Anchorman.
Virgin, Michael Gary Scott, okay. Anchorman. I mean, guys, the dude's
Dan in Real
catalog.
Life. Dan in Real yes. Life is a very underrated film.
Way, way back. I mean, he's the man.
Yeah, I'll give it to him. Steve Carell's enough to make me want to go see a movie.
Yes.
Jake, yes. You got Steve Carell into the honorable mentions.
I'm so happy. I love Steve Carell.
Welcome, 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 Steve Carell. Trevor, what is your nominee for honorable mentions?
Okay. I'm trying. We didn't really talk about this, but I assume that women are allowed to be honorable mentions, even though the
of
Yiddish
course.
Term doesn't technically allow for that.
Yes.
Nope.
We definitely, it says something. That it's hard to find a female director who even has consistently directed a lot of movies, which is depressing. Maybe Patty Jenkins will start getting more work now after her awesome Wonder Woman was, and we can talk about
Ava DuVernay
someday. Yeah, Ava DuVernay is great. Also, we'll always talk about A Wrinkle in Time. Super excited, still super excited. But I am gonna do our first female, and it is an actress. And it is, in my opinion, she is, in my opinion, the greatest actress of all time, in addition to the greatest living actress, and that is Ms. Meryl Streep.
So here's my thing about Meryl Streep. I concede that she is an incredible actress and is probably the greatest actress of all time, at least in the top five. But I, for some reason, like I don't seek out to watch her work. But I mean, considering she's won every other award, I think that we're probably beneath the judging quality of the Oscars. So sure. Yeah, I guess. Like,
sure is not a necessarily ringing endorsement from Jake.
I just honestly, like, I'm not that familiar with her work because I haven't sought it out or I don't know, but like her performance in Devil Wears Prada, I've seen that movie like 18 times, is phenomenal. And let me tell you what, Steve Carell's impersonation of her in The Office is also phenomenal. So I'm a yes.
Goodness.
I'm a yes.
Wow. Okay, I didn't think that was going to go that way. I feel like I'm the negative Nancy in every single like person we have.
Here's what I'll say while you're thinking, Cam. I haven't seen what I would say are a lot of her movies. She's great in everything I've ever seen her in. Also, the deciding factor for me for her putting her on this list is that a lot of the movies that she's in, if someone else was playing her role, there's no chance I would want to see it. But since she is in it, I am intrigued and interested.
That's fair.
No, that's a good way to look at it.
Okay, so to be devil's advocate here for a second. Actors, every actor is going to have bad work on their resume. Like sometimes you just got to get that check. Like for directors, it's different because they spend 3 years in pre-production, production, and post-production. Whereas an actor typically only spends like 50 days with the script and production. So I think we have to maybe look at actors different than directors. Because not everybody.
So are you saying that like we have to give actors like an 80%?
Yes. I think as Trevor said, or like same with Steve Carell, like for me, I know that movie's going to be trash, but like I'm intrigued because it's Steve Carell. Like just because I love Steve Carell and he's done such good work in other things. Meryl Streep's the same way. Like Benny and the Flash or whatever that stupid movie was that came out last year. It was like
Ricky and the Flash.
I don't care. Yes. I don't care. It looks horrible, but Meryl Streep in that role, you know, she might bring something to the table. You know, I think it's that kind of thing.
No, that's fair. And I'm not, I mean, yeah, you're right. You can never judge an actor on everything they've ever done. That's not completely fair. But what I'm trying to get through is if I knew nothing about the movie other than they're in it, is that enough to get me to go see the movie? Like, I'm trying to think of an actor that, like, I don't have an actor to nominate tonight. I have somebody that's not a director. But if I was like, okay, so let me say this. If all I knew about a movie was that Ryan Gosling was a part of it, I'm pretty intrigued just on the fact that he's a part of it, even though he's had bad movies. Like, what's that one? Only God Forgives. That's not a great movie. It's kind of a bad movie. He even like, Meryl Streep's in. She's a mensch.
I think, like you said, if they're batting 80%, then I think for an actor, that's like really good.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys are right. I don't know if I would actively seek out everything she does, but I am intrigued by anything that she attaches her name to.
Right. Yeah. Especially like if you have a couple people say like, oh, Florence Foster Jenkins is really good. You hear it from two or three people and you're like, that plus Meryl Streep means I'm going to spend the time to watch it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or like, that's for example, Will Smith hasn't made a good movie in a long while, but he has so much charisma that it's like, you know what? It's Will Smith though.
He's so cool. He's so cool.
Yeah. Like Johnny Depp, guys, right?
Ooh,
the menschest of menschest.
No, just veto always. What Permanent veto of Johnny Depp.
What if instead of watching a new movie every week, we just watched a movie that Meryl Streep was nominated for an Oscar in every week?
We would have enough for about half a year. How many times has she been nominated? I think she's up to 20 now.
It's really silly.
That is a good question.
It's silly how many she has.
Yeah. She's won, what, three?
Her nomination for an Oscar is like a participation award at like a kid's little league thing. It's like, you showed up and you're nominated for an Oscar and good job.
Meryl, you put out a movie this year? Great. Yeah, Oscar, here you go. Meryl Streep,
all right.
You are a mensch.
Cammy, let's hear it.
Okay. So this is a person who is one of the rare screenwriters that eclipses a director. And I mean that in terms of, it doesn't matter who's directing. If this person's writing, I'm in, because his scripts are just fantastic. We've talked about his shows on this podcast before. He is none other than the great Aaron Sorkin.
Yes.
All right. That was easy. That was easy. There you go.
I also agree. He has somehow eclipsed the glass ceiling of what a screenwriter can be and the input they have. And I mean, just, you could look at just The Social Network or just Newsroom or just The West Wing and say yes, but he has all of them. And so of course he's in.
A Few Good Men, The American President, and Social Network are like three of the 50 best scripts ever written.
Yeah. That was why he's not only does movies, he does TV, he does everything. And if you look at his past 10 years of work, he's directing his first movie that's supposed to come out later this year called Molly's Game. But the past 10 years, he has Steve Jobs, Newsroom, Moneyball, Social Network, and Charlie Wilson's War. I mean, that's
those
a pretty...
like, yeah, five of the top 100 movies in the last decade.
Yeah. So he's doing pretty well. I think he deserves to be a mensch. Aaron Sorkin, absolutely. Welcome to the honorable mensches. All right.
We will send you your leather vest in the mail. It's on its way.
Guys, the A Few Good Men script is like so good, I can't even watch the movie. It's like so overwhelming how good it is.
Trevor is blinded by how good the script is.
He can't handle the truth.
You can't handle
wants
the truth.
To read.
I can't handle how good the screenplay is.
I can't. You can't handle it.
All right. Do we want to talk trailers?
I'm interested in talking trailers. How do you guys feel?
I'll just run down my opinions real quick. Death okay. Wish looks like it was sponsored by the NRA and the Republican Party. Only the Brave looks like an America is Great cry fest that's going to win a bunch of Oscars. Looks good. Foreigner, love Jackie Chan. When he punches people in the face, awesome. Mother, so pumped. Love Black Swan, I'm a weirdo. Super excited about it. Mountain Between Us, ugh. What are you doing? Go home. Oh, wait, you can't. You're on a mountain. That's boom.
All righty.
Trailer
was,
talk.
That was
great. I'll run down that same list just as fast. Death Wish, good lord. I'm supposed to believe that Bruce Willis is a doctor or something? No way. Only the Brave.
That's the unbelievable part of Death Wish. Bruce Willis is a doctor.
No way. Only the Brave. Definitely a cry fest. Josh Brolin Oscar nom. You can see it in the trailer. I don't want to see it, but I'm definitely going to see it. The Foreigner.
Because you're on a podcast.
The Foreigner is like a bizarre reverse Taken. I'm not sure about it. Mother. As I said last week, the classic Aronofsky, you watch it once, it's amazing, you never want to see it again. And then Mountain Between Us, like, I think that Kate Winslet and Idris Elba just schemed a mountain vacation with a thin screenplay here.
Dude, you got to get those checks. Like, Idris Elba, Kate Winslet, incredible. Potential
Bo Bridges.
I was going to say, I'm not excited about it, but I would not be surprised if this was like a 95 Rotten Tomatoes with two crazy awesome performances.
I guess I will follow suit and give my quick thoughts. Mother, you're a terrifying trailer. The full trailer that came out today made me want to cry and curl up in a ball.
I loved it.
Javier Bardem, you're a terrifying man. Death Wish, I've lost all interest in... Bruce Willis at this point is an unmensch. He's an unmentionable actor. I have no interest in anything that Bruce Willis is a part of, which includes this. Mountain Between Us, bleh. Okay, so it's like, hey, we made The Gray with Liam Neeson, how can we make that a two-person thing with two Oscar nominated actors? Okay, there we go, boom. Only the Brave, I'm super interested in this, even though I can't stand Miles Teller. For some reason, Brolin's enough to make me interested in this, and the story kind of looks like unique and original and like something we haven't seen before, so awesome.
SEAL and Team the Foreigner, 6 of Firefighters.
You know. There we go. America. And The Foreigner was a movie that me and Trevor kind of ripped on a little bit last week, saying... it looks like a generic, like, it just doesn't look great. And I hadn't seen the trailer yet, and I was just kind of going off the premise I watched the trailer and I'm super in on this movie now.
It's a good Jackie trailer.
Jackie Chan was a huge part of my childhood. One of my favorite movies as a kid was Shanghai Noon. And watched so many classic Jackie Chan action movies back in the day. And so there's a soft spot in my heart for Jackie Chan. And I hope The Foreigner is amazing. And that's that. Let's go ahead and hop into our review of Detroit. So we all saw Detroit this week. I think we're all kind of shocked by how little other people saw it. It came in 8th at the box office and didn't do that well. My theater was pretty empty. I mean, I will say I saw it on a Sunday at 7:30. But still, it was kind of 7:30 a.m. Yes, I have this weird desire to just see movies super early in the morning during the weekends. But I mean, so it did. It went behind Dark Tower, Dunkirk, Emoji Movie's in third. How the heck is that happening? Girls Trip, Kidnap, Spider-Man Homecoming, Atomic Blonde, and then in 8th was Detroit.
It's crazy, man. This movie definitely came out at the wrong time, and it's a bummer because it's going to hurt Annapurna Pictures, which sucks because I think they're like one of the best indie studios in the business, and they took a huge risk on this movie. So not good. Not good.
Not good at all. Yeah, I don't... Yeah. Let's get some general thoughts. Jake, what are your general thoughts on this movie?
Okay, well, let's just go ahead and get this out of the way. We are three white guys from Texas talking about a very sensitive issue. White people have done horrible things to the black community. We are still doing horrible things to the black community. We are definitely not the most qualified group of people to give our opinions on the topic of this film. But I can safely say that we're human beings with hearts. Racism is wrong. True events that were portrayed in this movie were wrong. What's happening today in America 50 years later is still wrong. I can also say that the police have a terribly difficult job and that most of them are good people and just trying to protect their community and get home to their family safely. So, our opinions on this movie in no way reflect how we feel about what happened and is happening. And we will be reviewing this movie as it is, a standalone piece of art in the form of a film that says a lot of things about our past, present, and future. Now that that disclaimer from my lawyer has been taken and gotten out of the way, I have mixed feelings about this movie. I like it. It's very powerful and effective, but I think a lot of that comes from the fact that this is almost more of a horror/torture movie than a historical drama for a large part of it. I mean, we get to watch incredible actors portray police brutality for like an hour and a half, and that's really going to affect your audience. The performances in this movie are amazing. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if there were multiple Oscar nominations for this film. I have some issues with some directorial decisions of Kathryn Bigelow, but overall, I mean, this is a great, powerful movie, one that I think everyone should see and one that I think we'll be talking about again around Oscar season and probably for years to come. Trevor has this concept that I think we're probably going to make a segment one day of the Oscars 10 years later, like what should have won Best Picture. And I think this will be one of those films that if it doesn't win Best Picture, we'll be looking back 10 years later and asking, how was that not considered for Best Picture or the front runner? So, yeah, I liked this movie, but I also have mixed feelings. Trevor, what do you think?
I think this is a good movie that has some issues. I think it's a little bit of a mess. In the way that the story is told, I think that I think most of my issues are with the script itself. I think that Bull tries to do a little bit too much, maybe tries to tell too many different stories. Whereas we kind of get left in the dark a little bit. I think about kind of maybe the larger context of this. The Algiers incident, which is the main focus of the film, obviously. I think there's maybe too much exposition and too much conclusion/epilogue. I think that this as written may have played better as a miniseries that's 5 hours long or something like that, maybe. I think it's good. Bigelow's eye for action and realism is maybe unmatched by anyone else. She brings you into the film. You feel like you're inside it. I don't know. Like, there's just something missing from this. Like, it doesn't have. It's like a little bit hollow. I don't know. The acting performances are amazing. Will Poulter, who I've only seen play Cousin Eustace in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, is absolutely amazing. Good. He has
to get nominated.
He's like,
insane.
One of the most evil characters I've ever seen in a film. I mean, just like unbelievable. He's amazing. Algie Smith is incredible. I'm not familiar with him at all. I thought he was fantastic. I thought we didn't get enough Anthony Mackie, who's always great, I believe. The acting is great. I think the directing is very good. I think the script is kind of what lets this film down.
So I'm with you guys on this film. So let me say this. I think that this movie is an incredibly powerful story, but I think the way it's told on screen doesn't do service to the story that they're trying to tell.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say about the script. Yeah. I agree.
I think this movie's wildly carried. I mean, I can't think of a movie in recent memory that's more carried by the actors that are in it. And normally I would give credit to the director for having so many great actors, but there are so many directorial choices that I disagreed with that I just think that the actors, like, I give so much credit to the actors in this film. I mean, you can run down the list of actors. John Boyega is fantastic in this movie. Will Poulter is terrifying. There's a scene where he smiles at one of the girls, and it's the most menacing smile you've ever seen in a movie, ever.
Oh my gosh.
Algie Smith is amazing. Gosh, talk about a voice. Like, that guy can sing. I want to hear him do a record. Jacob Lattimore is great. Jack Rayner is great. Anthony Mackie's fantastic with the time that he's given. I mean, there's so many people on this list. Hannah Murray,
John
and
Krasinski.
Deaver.
What? John Krasinski?
Yeah, John Krasinski. He like brought the pain in this one. Good Lord.
Yeah.
I think he's trying to do more directing, and he just like wanted to hang out with Catherine Bigelow. So he was like, yeah, sure. I'll be in it for 3 minutes.
Well, what's interesting about John Krasinski is that the really only thing that he's doing next is the Amazon series Jack Reach or Jack Ryan. So,
oh, I forgot that John's doing that.
Yeah, he is in that. He is Jack Ryan. So we'll see what happens. But I think this movie is wildly carried by the actors in it. And I think without these actors giving the performance that they do, this movie falls completely flat. I think the epilogue and the prologue to some extent take away from the main story at the Algier. I get that the prologue kind of contextualizes what's going on in Detroit, but I think that could have been done with like a 5-minute scene, and we could have jumped right into the dramatics singing right before they're about to go on stage, and we would have still had the same effect. I don't think that it adds anything to the movie outside of maybe contextualizing where Will Poulter's character is at in his career. And I think that could have been thrown in right as we get introduced to him a little bit later. I don't even know if we need that whole scene. I mean, you could have just done the scene at the detective place where he's getting in trouble, and I think it would have made sense. But I don't know. Like, I think there's a movie within this that's a great movie. But I think that the script and the prologue and epilogue keep it from being that great movie. I think if you cut this down to like an hour 45 and it's mostly just the Algier stuff, I think it's a much better movie.
I agree with you, but I also disagree in certain, like, so I don't know about you guys, but like, I usually try to not do a lot of research on a film and just let the film speak for itself. But like with a film like this, based on such important historical events, I couldn't really help myself. Like I wanted to know more about this true story that I didn't really know anything about. And like granted, no film, not even a documentary, is bias free. Like totally get that. That's the job of the filmmaker, to present an argument of their creative vision. But like when you're taking on a historical event, there's this added weight of responsibility as you're telling a story that not a lot of people know about. Like I understand that some things are omitted, and I also assume that a lot of things were added for dramatic effect, but I personally wish that Bigelow did a better job at setting the scene of the Detroit riots. Like we go from opening club scene with no impact on the film at all, which was good, but like it happens and then it's just over. And it's not enough for me to feel the weight of why the riots are happening. We go from people getting arrested for running an illegal club to riots, like burning down the city, F the police. And there was this long period of activism and uprising going on before we're dropped into the film. And you just don't get that sense of like the Black community in Detroit. Like I think if there was 20 minutes of fat in this movie that could have been cut to make room for the weight that the riots deserved, I think it then makes everything that happened at the motel more impactful to the viewer.
Yeah.
'Cause you are now in the heads of these Black characters getting assaulted by these white police officers. Like, I don't know. I think Bigelow and Bowles specifically chose to leave a lot of things out that I strongly disagree with. And I don't know if she was the right director for the project. I'm not
like,
saying
what
that
did they
like,
leave?
She's
I haven't done much research,
woman, but
I haven't done
well,
much
I,
research.
I think,
but what did they leave out that you're like, that should have been in there?
So like I said, I don't know a ton about the actual historical facts, but I did some research today. So before all of this stuff happens, there was this giant activism in the Black community going on against huge systemic corruption and racism in the Detroit Police Department and justice system. And instead, this makes the cops seem as they're just like a few bad eggs. And there's just a lot of choices with the actual script of, like, according to multiple interview testimonies and the legal trial, like the Black characters were telling the police officers about the starter pistol. Like that was actually happening
right
during the interrogations. Like, why not include that in the film? Because as the entire time they're talking about this, I'm like, the dude's dead. Just tell him about the starter pistol. So she intentionally chose to leave that out. And it in no way helps the story. It hurts the story because it's, first off, it's not what happened. And secondly, now there's this like plot hole. And thirdly, you're doing a disservice to your characters by making them seem, I don't know. I just, when you're playing with real people's lives, real historical facts, there's this weight of responsibility that's put on you as a filmmaker. And I just think that a lot of the directorial choices that they made did not help the story.
Yeah, I think the reason why I said there's too much prologue is because the prologue I don't think it does what it's supposed to do.
It's pointless.
It doesn't like you were saying, Jake, it doesn't contextualize the riots. It just makes it look like that this group of Black people is mad that a bunch of white cops showed up, so they're going to start burning down the city. And it almost like perpetuates this stereotype that some white people have about riots and everything.
Yeah, because I felt that way in the theater. I was thinking like, why are they burning down their city? And then when I got home and did research on the actual what was happening in Detroit, I was like, holy crap, this is insane.
Right. Yeah, I read a lot about it today. And I mean, you can't just throw screen after screen of text up there in a feature film. But I don't know. I feel like what that this film is missing. I mean, aside from the specific event at the Algiers, the rest of the film is missing the nuance that a story like this requires.
Yeah, agreed. It feels rushed to me. The story does, and I say that in the terms of, we talked about the prologue not giving the right context, but if there's so much information for them to go on, why did they show what they showed instead of contextualizing it to where we had a better understanding? And I get, so I'm going to use a different example, but the idea that just came to my mind was, I knew very little about the whole O.J. Simpson trial outside of O.J. Simpson supposedly killed his ex-wife and a friend of hers and then didn't go to jail. That's all I knew. And the documentary series gives you a full context. Now, that is a 10-hour documentary, but that, I'm pretty sure you could narrow that down and give me, you know, the exact same amount of time. Like, I think we take like 15, 20 minutes of prologue before we actually get to our main story. And I think that if the director or writer had taken that 15, 20 minutes, contextualized the riots in the right way, and given us a little bit more background on our characters, I think this movie would be a lot more emotionally impactful. And so for me, it comes down to a bad script and bad directing choices.
Yeah. Everything outside of the motel, like you said, it just feels like a very strange decision from the screenplay perspective.
Yes.
And it also, like I said before, I understand that there's bias and perspective when you're making a film. There has to be. It's inherent because we're human beings. But the prologue in this makes no sense and no impact on the story as a whole. And then there's probably, like I said, 20 minutes of fat just going on throughout the rest of the film that you could have cut and used that time to make a really impactful prologue and make this film 15 minutes shorter. So
yeah.
I just don't understand those decisions. Granted, I mean, all that negativity said, this is still a very well done and powerful film. Like, it is impactful, and technically it is very, very well done. So
right. I think
let's give credit where credit is due. So yeah. To me the two stars of this movie, there are really three stars in this movie to me. And they are Algie Smith, Jacob Lattimore, and Will Poulter. And I say, like, Jacob Lattimore and Algie Smith, the relationship developed between them is so real and so raw that as they're looking at each other, and to get into spoilers, so spoilers from here on out, if you haven't go see the movie, please go see it. If you have, please continue listening to this episode. There's a scene where they try to break out from the house when the three cops aren't watching. And that was the most gut-wrenching scene for me, because you feel that hopelessness in that moment. And I feel like part of that was because we felt such a connection to those two characters, because we saw their genuine friendship. We had already been through a struggle with them, with Algie Smith just wanting to perform so bad, and the performance getting called off because of the riots. And you see Jacob Lattimore trying to, like, console him. And that was, to me, the strongest part. And then you have this terrifying villain in Will Poulter who can make you pee your pants with just a simple glare. And so I think this movie, like, the actors in this movie deserve all the praise. I think the majority of the praise in this movie should be going towards the actors. And I hope that that's, come Oscar season, who gets all the praise is the actors.
Also, like, every supporting person in this film, like, the two girls were great. Anthony Mackie was great. All the other cops, the National Guardsmen, I mean, every single one of them, like, really brought it. It is an incredibly acted film.
Yeah. And there's that scene early on where, oh, what was his name? The guy who had the toy gun.
Yeah, Carl Cooper.
Where he has the toy gun and they're in that room and they're going through that idea of like what it's like to be stopped by a cop. That scene was incredibly tense. And once again, I think that's due to the actors and how they sell that scene. And I think that that's, once again, an actor's, like, I look at all of this and most times I give credit to a director and being able to pull that performance, but I don't know why it feels like the director's choices were bad. And part of this was just, you know, Kathryn Bigelow getting out of the way and letting the actors chew on these scenes. And I think that's the real strength of this script. So I'm a huge Kathryn Bigelow fan. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty and Hurt Locker are amazing. And so top three films in the years that they came out. But this is a miss for me in a lot of places because of the excess in it. I think when it's good, it's great. And when it's not good, it's kind of, you know, it just feels like, okay, let's get to the interesting part. You know what I'm saying?
The frustration for me is not only that this could have been a great movie, but it also could have been a really important movie. And I think it is an important movie, but I think the weight of it could have been a lot stronger if it's a little bit tighter and a little bit easier to watch.
This could have been Crash. Like, this could have been as important as Crash, guys.
For a second I thought you were serious there. I'm like, wait, what?
I thought you were too. I was like, wait, Jake, you know Crash is terrible, right?
Let me ask you guys this.
That's so bad.
I get what they're going for and wanting to give the characters their full story. But did having the epilogue in there kind of let the tension and let the tension out of the movie? So I mean this as, like, I look at a movie like Captain Phillips, which is an okay movie, but the end scene just, like, is the most dramatic scene. It just leaves you. I'm trying to imagine this film if we didn't get the whole epilogue and we just kind of got, like, the end of the scenes at the Algiers, and then it cut to black and gave, like, a text description of what everything else that happened. Do you guys think that would have been more impactful?
I think so, but just because the way that the epilogue was handled was pretty weak, in my opinion, and kind of confusing the way that they did the judge talking and the, like, I don't know. It just seemed unnecessary, but this goes back to my previous point of, like, actual historical facts and what to include and what not to include. So what I found out after researching this story is the black community knew that the cops were going to get off. So what they did was they staged their own trial, and 2,000 people came to a church as they basically created their own trial and proclaimed the cops guilty because they knew that was the only way that they were going to get justice. That, I think, would have been more powerful as if you bring the jury out and they say guilty and the gavel hits and then nothing happens. And then text comes on the screen to say, this was a response of the black community knowing that they would not receive justice. The three white officers were found not guilty, blah, blah, blah. Nothing happened. Like, I think that's how you end the film. And it's just like, dang, this is still happening today, you know? Like, but instead we get this 30-minute dragged out, just little glimpses of scenes that really have no impact on the rest of the film.
Yeah.
See, that sounds much better.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That would have been a much better way to end the film. Because this it falls flat. It's a little bit confusing. As you said, Jake, it's I guess they were trying to make it a little bit less complicated because there were different times where all the three police officers plus the security guard, Dismukes, were all on trial together for certain things. There were separate trials for separate crimes. So I understand kind of trying to bring all that in together for kind of this one thing, but it's a little bit jumbled. It's a little bit disjointed. And it doesn't quite, I don't know, just the way that everything was organized, it didn't work for me.
Yeah. What did you guys think about the cinematography?
So I have mixed feelings about it. Like, I understand the choice of why they did what they did, but I wasn't a huge film of the way it was shot for the whole film. Like, I know that they created a pre-lit set And so they had multiple cameras running at a time to get as much coverage. But everything felt like a tight 70 millimeter shaky cam. And it gives this kinetic, unsettling feeling. But when a whole film is shot that way, even when you don't need a really tight perspective, it just got bland, I guess that's the right word, but also like uncomfortable. I was like, okay, Algie Smith is singing. We don't need to be this close to his lips. Is this telling the shaky story visually?
Yeah. And I think the shots lost their impact because of that. Like at a certain point, like the tensions just let out and I'm left with a headache instead of feeling tension from these scenes. And so that was a major takeaway.
I get why they do it though. Cause I mean, when you're running multiple cameras to get coverage, you have to go tight. So then you're not like cutting each other's lines off or like getting each other in the shot. And then also, I mean, this is a pretty small budget for the story they're trying to tell. And so the best way to cover up a bad budget is to show as little of the set as possible.
Yeah. But and Jake, that's an interesting point. I didn't know that about the pre-lit set, but I think that definitely helps the actors in kind of giving the best performance. So
yeah, it gives them way more freedom and it shows in the performances for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I thought it was too shaky, too much. I think there are times where it helps and adds to it, but it's like the whole thing. It's like, it's kind of like, I don't know. It felt like Cloverfield at times, except the excuse wasn't that a character was holding the camera.
Yeah. Or like the first 20 minutes of the first Hunger Games, but it was like that for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Do you guys have any other thoughts on this film?
I have a couple things, I guess. One, the title of this movie is really silly and very reductive. It would have been better as, I don't know, The Algiers or The Algiers Incident or something that doesn't reduce a whole city to this one thing. And I say that as someone who lives in Waco and has lived through many planned iterations of a David Koresh movie or TV show just called Waco, which is incredibly unfair to this great city that I live in. The people of Detroit having their movie just be called Detroit and it's about a bunch of racist police officers in the 60s. It's an unfair title.
Especially when you don't give the whole perspective of why the riots were happening and what caused this incident. And yeah, I'm with you, Trevor.
Right. And especially in a city as Detroit that's having as tough of a time the last 20 years as this city has. It feels wrong. The other thing, I kind of wonder if there's a couple of things. I know that I don't know. It seems like the studio maybe wasn't super happy with this film. Maybe that's why there's a lack of attention, a lack of marketing. I don't know. It seemed like I didn't even see a trailer for this in front of a movie until like 2 weeks ago. So I don't know.
Yeah, there was like no marketing.
Yeah, no marketing, as you guys mentioned. And then this is a very Oscar film, but it's released the first weekend of August.
Yeah.
Like this is a November, end of December. Like this feels like an end of December, like limited release, wide release, like first weekend of January film.
So this goes back to like what I was talking about with Annapurna Pictures. They like intentionally went counter programming with this, like, oh yeah, let's put it at the end of summer and against Dark Tower because everyone's going to be sick of blockbusters. And like, so that was apparently like a very intentional choice. And then I'm also assuming that they spent the whole budget on making the film, trusting that Kathryn Bigelow's name would be enough of a marketing pull. And then they didn't have money for marketing.
Yeah, I guess so. And I would have thought that Bigelow and Bull even together would have been more of a pull. But I guess, especially after Zero Dark Thirty, but I mean, who doesn't want to go see the story of Osama bin Laden dying? So maybe there was a little bit of an artificial bump there.
And her last film was like, what, 5 years ago? I mean, she's kind of out of the cultural zeitgeist. Like she's...
Well,
I don't know.
She was working on the Bo Bergdahl movie for a couple years. I don't know what happened with that. I don't know if that's just like dropped and they're not doing that at all. I don't know if they're waiting for his trial to conclude.
I mean, if anyone makes that movie, it's Bigelow and Bull. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of movie that they make.
But what a great like director writer group, like team name. Bigelow and Bull.
Man. Yeah. That's pretty great.
I love that. Yeah, I mean I think their style is good though. Like I said, I love The Hurt Locker. Love Zero Dark Thirty. Zero Dark Thirty is like, if you don't think Jessica Chastain's a fantastic actress, just go watch 5 minutes of that movie and you're sold. So I think that Kathryn Bigelow has good stories to tell. I just think that this movie is kind of a mess story-wise, and is luckily saved by the actors. But
so quick question, like last thought for me. Did you guys like think about this movie at all after you left the theater?
Like, no.
It weirdly just like evaporated out of my head, which is the last thing you want with this kind of movie.
Oh, it definitely stayed with me.
Okay. Then I'm just horrible.
No, I don't think you're horrible. I think the emotional impact isn't there as much as you would expect a film like this to have. And like Jake said earlier, we're three white guys from Texas, and so the emotional impact this is going to have on us is obviously a lot different than it will on a lot of people. But the emotional impact wasn't as there.
I think it's the epilogue. Like, the epilogue was this weird, like, 30-minute cool-down of, like...
Yeah, it takes the air out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it just kind of... I left, and I was like, wow, that was powerful. And then I got home and talked with my wife about it for a little bit. But since then, besides this morning, like, actually writing out my thoughts, I haven't thought about it really at all.
I'll say, the thing that sticks with me is Will Poulter's character... pacing back and forth, staring at these black teenagers with their hands and faces up against the wall. That's what really sticks with me about this film.
I mean, that image will be burned into my brain for sure.
I think, so in thinking about this past couple of minutes, I think what sticks with me more is the general story, but not necessarily the weight of it that I would expect a movie. Like, it's the story and the performances that stick with me, and not like the weight that you would expect a movie like this to have.
Same. That's what I'm trying to say is like, oh, that's a thing, and I'm going to look it up and see what actually happened. And man, those performances were good, but like, this film didn't punch me in the gut like I think it was supposed to. It did during watching the film, but like, leaving, I was.
Yeah, like I expect more. I expect to like walk out of a movie like this and like still be thinking about it like a week later of like, man, that hit me so hard. Like what that did to me emotionally. I always say like the best movies are movies that like sit with you for and like get better as time goes on. And if anything, I've been more frustrated with how this story's told as time goes on, because I think it's an important and powerful story, but I think the way that it's told in the movie doesn't do service to the actual story that needs to be told.
Yeah. I think if they end with like Jake was saying with the tribunal of the black citizens, I think that's a gut punch. That's something that really sticks with you. And I think in it's, I don't know. There's a couple things I guess I want to say on that. One, in her review for RogerEbert.com, I believe her name is Angelica Bostein, maybe. She writes for Roger Ebert. May he rest in peace. She says, she talks, a big question she asks is, who is this movie for? And I think that's an important question because there's not really an answer. It's almost like, there should have been more of a commentary on these events, but they're under the standard thing that Bull and Bigelow have worked under of trying to be factual and realistic without offering commentary. Except in this case, the commentary would be, I don't know, pretty generally accepted as being acceptable. So I don't know. I feel like the decision to avoid the Black Citizen Tribunal is a decision to avoid, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but avoid any kind of commentary on what happened.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and get to our ratings for the film. Jake, what would you give this film?
I sound really down on this film. I feel like I say that every single episode that we do. Like, I just complain and complain. But I do have a lot of frustrations with this film, especially directorial choices. But I think it sheds light on a very serious, true story that a lot of people don't know, including myself. And I think it does it in a powerful way. And I mean, the performances alone in this film make this thing have legs. And so I'm going to give this a high B. It's not a B+, but I think this is, I can recommend this to anybody. Like, you should watch this film at least once, but I don't know if I will rewatch it anytime soon. So for me, it's a B. Trevor, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a good film, and I think it's an important film. Its frustration with me is that it could have been a great film, like an all-time great film, I think, with some slightly different decisions. Out of respect for the subject matter, I guess I will not give it one of my silly rating scales this week because I couldn't really come up with anything that seemed appropriate at all.
I was a little worried, honestly. I was like, "Ooh, what's Trevor gonna say?"
I'm gonna give this I'm gonna give it 3 out of 4 stars on the Ebert scale. The acting carries it. It's almost there. It's almost trending towards 3.5, but there's just a few things that kind of, as Cam was saying, the more I sit with it, the more I'm kind of frustrated that it wasn't as good as it could have been.
Yeah, I'm frustrated with how some of the elements of this movie were handled. I think it's a C- film with A+ acting, which to me is like a B of a film. Like I said, I think there's a good film in here.
A really good way to put
here.
It.
Yeah, I think there's a really good film in here. I think that if parts of the prologue were shot to better contextualize the overall events, and if the film cut a lot of the epilogue out, I think this film is a lot more impactful. That's not to say that the scenes that happen in the film aren't impactful, but what you're left with is the epilogue, and the epilogue kind of, like we said, takes the tension out of the room at the end. So I love the acting in this movie. All the actors in this movie should just be super proud of how they portrayed and did justice to the characters on screen. So yeah, it's a B for me. That's that. That's our review of Detroit. Let's get to our content of the week. Trevor, what is your content of the week?
I have an un-content of the week, which is don't go watch Crash because it's terrible.
I like this, a new segment called un-content of the week. Are you Crash uncontent with this content?
Probably the worst movie to win an Oscar ever.
Best picture. Not an Oscar. Best picture.
Right. Yeah.
Suicide Squad did win an Oscar, so... there's that.
Anyway, that's enough on Crash. I'll recommend, there's a song on the Detroit soundtrack that played during the credits by The Roots that is fantastic.
Yes.
The song is called It Ain't Fair, and it's so good. The Roots are amazing. I think they're one of the best hip-hop rap artists, whatever you want to put them in. I mean, they're a band that raps. They're awesome. I mean, they're also on Fallon, which is really cool. So yeah, check out that song by The Roots. And I don't know. I wish there was like a documentary about this that I could point people to that I could watch myself, because I think that would be pretty fascinating. So I have uncontent and I have frustratingly non-content this week.
Jake, what about you?
So I have three things. One is a film that unexpectedly blew me away. And this was recommended to me by our friend Chris Ramirez. And this is a Korean horror zombie film called Train to Busan. You can find it on Netflix. And it's one of the best movies I've seen this year. I loved this movie. Granted, I love good horror. And this is really good horror zombie film. It's not so much like gory as it is just like intense and a really well told story. It is a Korean film, so there's subtitles, but honestly, Korea puts out some of the best cinema in the world. And so this is a horror movie that totally flips the script on the typical zombie film. This is basically 28 Days Later meets Snowpiercer. And it's amazing. My second recommend is Tickled. It's this very weird documentary on HBO about the secret underground.
I love that we're talking about this.
Competitive endurance tickling. And if that doesn't sound crazy enough, the rabbit hole goes deep, my friends. And it's
like that's
insane.
Such a sub level or like surface level description, and like that's all you can give though.
Yeah, it's insane. It's one of those films where you watch it and you're like, there's no way this is real, and then as it's progressing you're like, there's no way this is fake because it's so insane. Highly recommend it. It's an HBO documentary, so I think it might exclusively be on HBO, but you might be able to find it on iTunes or something. And then finally, some sad news, guys, that I think I might be breaking to you right now in my recommend. Mute Math broke up. So
no.
Yeah. So go listen to this woefully underappreciated band's music, because I think that they are one of the most musically talented bands of the last decade. And they have some amazing albums. So check out Mute Math anywhere that you listen to music. Cameron, what about you?
Gosh, darn it. Well, I'm heartbroken now. Thanks a lot, Jake.
Sorry, man. Just trying to get the word out.
Wow. Okay. It's hit me pretty hard. Okay. I'm gonna get past it.
Okay. fight through, man. Fight through.
Fight through. Okay. My recommend of the week is a film, a very unseen British film, featuring John Boyega, who is one of the stars of Detroit. And it's his very first film. It's called Attack the Block. And I'm going to give you a very quick description, because I normally when I tell people about this film, all you need is a quick description. That's really all you should know. So here's the movie. Imagine a ghetto block in London and a bunch of teenage boys take on an alien invasion. That's it.
Love it.
That's what you need to know. And it's amazing. It's John Boyega's first film. It's also like the only film that he uses his natural British accent in, which what
it's
the heck is up with
super
that?
British. It is super British.
But like in every, like Star Wars, Imperial Dreams, Detroit, The Circle, everything that he's in, he has an American accent. Like, just let the guy talk in British. His accent's so cool. Like, you'll understand. Yeah, talking British. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Trevor. Talking British. Not American, okay? Please go see Attack the Block. It's amazing. Edgar Wright produced it, which if you don't already love Edgar Wright, go check out his stuff. But yeah, it's fantastic. Fun, comedy, action. That deserves to be seen way more than it has been seen. So that's all we have for tonight. Episode 15 is done. And guys, a little bit of breaking news is outside of the whole Mute Math thing, but as we've been sitting here, Lionsgate CEO has announced that the Hunger Games and Twilight films have more stories to tell. So more Hunger Games and Twilight. What do you guys want to? You guys want to do a Twilight episode first or Hunger Games first? What do you guys want to do? Come on.
I think I'll be dead by then.
So in the next
hold on, let me check my planner. Let me check. Yep, I will be dead by then. So we're
okay. Yeah. Okay, good to know. Alrighty, if you have enjoyed listening to us tonight, please go check us out on iTunes. Subscribe. Give us a rating, give us a review, let us know what you thought about us. If you want to connect with us more, you can find us on Twitter at Popcorn Optional. If you want to find out more about us, who we are, send us an email. You can go to our website at popcornoptional.com. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me on Twitter at 321CamiTime. Jake, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at jakebrown.tv. I'm starting to do this new thing where I break down shots and like how I shot them and how I lit them and stuff like that. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, check it out. Trevor, what about you?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at TurboTrevor, and coming soon I'll have some better recommends than I've had the last couple weeks because they haven't been super exciting.
Awesome. Well, we have enjoyed talking to you guys tonight. We hope that you guys have a great week, and until next time, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Y'all be good.